This podcast is a TOEFOP production.
Head to TOEFOP.com for more.
The following episode of TOEFOP is rated MA for mature audiences. It may contain sexual references, time travel references, allegations of bin misconduct, and mild coarse language. TOEFOP advises that this episode is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who thinks a comedy conversation between two old mates sounds like a terrible idea for a show. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Everyone relax. This is TOEFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Will Addison. Hello and thank you for watching. Wow, that off-air banter really gave me some great confidence about how hilarious this podcast would be.
I can sense we've only chatted for a couple of minutes before we hit record, and I can sense there's a general fatigue settling into the podcast from both ends. You're back in Melbourne. I'm still in the Northern Rivers. Would I be right in suggesting you're feeling a bit tired?
I am a little bit tired. It's fair to say I am tired of life. No, I am tired of this mundane existence that we have now signed ourselves up for. No, it's been really interesting because, like, doing shows at the Comedy Festival has in some ways been the most amazing thing because for me, you know, without wanting to overstate it, like, it's the first thing that goes in my diary every year. 2020 would have been 25 years in a row. Like, without having this, regular structure in my life being the way that it's always been, that it's it wasn't until I came to do it that I fully was aware of how much that I missed it. But that said, It is also still COVID times. There are people staying away because of COVID and, there are people in masks in the show, and my existence is literally I go to the show, I come back to this hotel room, I lock myself in the hotel room all day so that I don't catch COVID. I go out, I go for like a walk, I go back, I lock myself in the hotel room. So I've now officially been locked in a hotel room for long enough that my existence, I do feel like a lab rat or like a...
You look like... one of those, like, when the refugee advocates will do an interview with someone who's been detained, like, that's what it looks like. I mean, you've got this camera set up in your room. It's like, it's just that blank wall in the background. And for all intents and purposes, like, you could be saying to me, Charlie, get me out of the comedy festival.
Yeah,
please.
I'm in prison. Could you please get a march together to release me from, could you get Merlin to go on the Celebrity Big Brothers reunion and have free the... comedians,
because free to comedians.
I was saying this to Cameron James, who is the guest on FOFOP this week, but this year, in a way, funnily enough, because obviously if you get COVID or you're COVID exposed, you miss a week of shows. So most comedians are not drinking, they're not going out, they're staying inside. Their voices are great. Like, you're seeing them, their absolute best. Like, there's probably never actually been a better time to come and see comedians because everybody is just like sitting around all day in their hotel rooms. And then, like, you get that hour outside, your exercise time where you can go and tell some jokes for an hour and then go back to your little gray prison.
Yeah, it's funny. We went and saw Dave Graney. He was playing some gigs up here about a month ago, I think, up at one of the pubs up here. And so Jem and I went along with Adam Zwire, who's been on FOFOP a couple of times, and his wife. And they are friendly with Dave. And so after the gig, Dave and his partner, Claire, came out to say hello. But they came out like in triple masked, like gloves on. They stood about like 2 meters from us, it was like, it was so awkward because we're like, I'd never met them before. I was like, thanks for the gig. It was really great. I had a really good time. And they're just like, like two mummies just standing there. Like, and they only wanted to sort of be out there for a couple of minutes because it's like, there's just too many general public around here and it's the Northern Rivers. We can't be out here for too long. We've got more gigs to play.
Right. Well, that's, once you have that on the line, like I'm now in the window that if I got a COVID strike of any kind, the rest of my festival's done. So it does raise the stakes.
You should get one of those Zorbs. you know, like Boy in the Bubble, like get one of those orbs you get from New Zealand and just roll it from your hotel to the show. Like, I mean, that way people are definitely going to be 2 meters from you.
Mate, I'd be happy to like do the show in a Zorb. If that Zorb technology is available, then I'm happy to like, I'll get in my Zorb, go for a bit of a roll around the city, you know, like that ball of wool did in that. I'm just like, you know what? You had a cotton wool ball doing it. You put it in ads all over the world. I can roll around in my Zorb. So I go down the street, I get a coffee.
Stick
in
some
Zorb.
Flyers to the outside of your Zorb. So they're just like flying off. Is it rolling?
Oh, yeah,
the street?
Like promotion. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically, I'm just going for a walk and doing some promo in my Zorb. Like, obviously, I have to leave a bit of a gap between the posters so I can see up my Zorb to get around. But then, I do a little roll around town in my Zorb, maybe go down to the gardens or something down by the Yarra. I could even float in my Zorb, couldn't I? Like, I imagine my Zorb, I could just, like, go up the Yarra if there's too much
action.
Too much traffic on the footpath. So I just, like, pop onto the Yarra.
I don't know if anyone's rolled a Zorb uphill. I don't know if that is physically possible. But, you know, I mean, you should give it a shot at least. Why not? It'd be great publicity for the show. Like, have you seen Will Anderson's show? Will Anderson, he's the guy been rolling around Melbourne the last 3 weeks in an inflatable ball? Yeah. That one.
The Zorb guy. It's a bit late in my career to make a pivot, but I think I could be the Zorb guy. You know, I really like him now that he's in his Zorb. He just feels comfortable in his Zorb.
Yeah. Well, you would, Ben. You wouldn't worry about hecklers, would you? There's no worries about like Will Smith taking offense to any of your jokes.
The ultimate defense. Like that. I'll be hosting the Oscars next year because I'm the only comedian that can be fully protected. He only performs in a Zorb.
It would be fairly undignified, though, that he slaps your Zorb and you just roll off stage into the orchestra pit.
Yeah, that's right. He comes up, gives me the full whack, and my Zorb hasn't been anchored properly. I haven't put out my little Zorb anchor. I just roll like really slowly into the orchestra pit. It's just like nothing I can do about it.
And you just get stuck in the tuba. I went to Blues Fest on Friday.
Yeah, how was that?
Well, that was weird. I honestly felt strange being in that many, because it was fairly well attended. I actually was expecting, I mean, Blues Fest is a fairly relaxed festival as it is. Like, it's not like a, you know, Splendor or whatever. It's just like crammed. Like, generally it's family friendly and you can move around. And
so for people who don't know what you're talking about, we're talking about the Byron Bay Blues Festival, a blues and roots, like, but not just really blues and roots music. Like, I mean, there is,
they've widened the categories a fair bit, I would say. There's like hip hop there. There's like a whole bunch of kind of artists.
But it is a much more family friendly pitched festival than those sort of big rock and pop festivals. And
famously, the festival where the Counting Crows came 1 year and refused to play Mr. Jones, which people still talk about to this day. I heard a few people mention, like, it's the most memorable gig for the wrong reasons that ever played Blues Fest.
Yeah. Well, this is the story of Blues Fest. Blues Fest has been cancelled the last 2 years in the week that it was going to happen. So it's an independently produced festival, one of the few in Australia. And literally they had built the festival site both years, like outlaid so many of the costs, advertising and all those sort of things, only for it to be cancelled at the very last moment. So the fact that it is
last year, they cancelled it off the back of one positive COVID case.
Right. Which turned out to not turn into many more than that.
Adorable when you think about it, if it wasn't the fact that so many people lost thousands, if not millions of dollars.
I mean, it was an absolute tragedy for the community, and yet still only second and third behind the Counting Crows not playing Mr. Jones.
So it was actually pretty well attended, and I think obviously people are just so desperate for something. Like, there was a whole mix, young people who I wouldn't expect to see at Blues Fest there, like, you know, and like kids, teenage boys and girls just desperate to get nude, like just shirtless guys. It was fairly chilly on Friday night, like 16 degrees, but the dudes were still shirtless and the girls are still running around in their bra tops. It's like, you were determined to have a festival experience regardless, whatever the lineup was going to be, whatever the weather conditions were going to be. It's like, you got your pasties, you're ready just to go and have a festival experience, which, by the way, have you noticed, and this is going to make us sound old for the millionth time on the show, but the 90s are so back, like in terms of fashion. Like, there are young people, like in their late teens, early 20s, who I swear to God, I'm like having flashbacks. It's like, you look like the guys I went to uni with. Like, there was a girl the other day who looked like she was out of the Matrix. like the way she had her hair braided and the little glasses and she was wearing a mesh top. It was like the most 90s goth, like industrial techno look I've ever seen. It's like, it's back, baby. I mean, does that mean we're hip again? Because that was our era, the 90s?
Well, I was just thinking that, and I was kind of thinking in my timeline, is there a chance that I could be like recaptured as sort of like a 90s icon, like, you know, ironically recaptured by the next generation.
And yeah, like a David Hasselhoff kind of thing. Or
I think, unfortunately, I'm more early 2000s because I started Triple J in 2000 and then like Glasshouse comes after that. So if there's ever going to be some sort of like Will Anderson
nostalgia. You and Sum 41 get on the same bill.
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely going to be early 2000s. So I've got to wait for the early 2000s to become cool again. But yes, our fashion and our taste in things is very much back.
Yeah, it's very much back. And so, because the lineup this year for Blues obviously is 100%, or I'm pretty sure 100% Australian. Obviously, they just didn't want to take the risk of booking international gigs. So Friday night was like...
And we say 100% Australian, and we mean that because Crowded House played, and they are 100% Australian, as we've always said in Australia.
We've always said. But Friday night was like my teens all over again because the two headline acts were Hoodoo Gurus and Midnight Oil.
Yeah.
And I think we've done many episodes on the Hoodoo Gurus. Like we both love
But how were Gurus. They? Like how did they play?
Fantastic. Like really, really good. A friend of mine knows them and she said afterwards that they were a bit like deflated. They didn't think they'd had a very good gig. They weren't happy with the sound mix and stuff. But I thought they sounded great. Like they are just, they've just got so many hits. Like that's the thing about the Hoodoo Gurus. But seeing them now too, like the last time I saw them was when you did that, you did a benefit for, the Bondi Pavilion or something?
It was the Bondi Pavilion benefit and the Hoodoo Gurus play.
Yeah, they did a very casual kind of like, you know, five songs. This was a proper like 1 hour show. And I was with our mate VK and we were both saying like, if you closed your eyes, like they are just the most like, you know, the biggest party band and they just sound like so rock and roll and they're so great. But then you open your eyes and you look at them and it's just like a bunch of accountants, like especially Dave. Like Vaughn kept saying, I didn't realize Flacco played rock and roll. Like, yeah, he's got a real Flacco vibe about him. Like they sound so rock. And then we were sort of like going, I said, but what genre do they fit in? Are they kind of like surf rock? Are they psychedelic rock? Because they sort of like, they sort of drift in and out of all these different genres. But they were playing some new music and the difference between the old tracks, like the songs you knew, and then the new tracks was like very stark. Like there was just something, I mean, it wasn't just the familiarity, that it just sounded different. Like it didn't have that kind of Hoodoo Gurus energy. It felt like maybe a band, you know, doing a version of the Hoodoo Gurus, but they were still great. If I'd seen them in isolation, I would have been like, well, that was an amazing gig and, you know, what an icon. But then they were followed by Midnight Oil, who I haven't seen. I saw them at the fire benefit in 2008 and I was like, well, thank God that no one will ever have to raise money for natural disasters in Australia.
Yeah, once in a lifetime.
We solved it. Climate change is solved. And then prior to that, I remember seeing them on it was probably the Blue Sky Mine Tour in like 91, 92 when I was like 13. My brother got me tickets to see them. So I was like, oh, yeah, you know, Midnight Oil. I wanted to see them more as a legacy kind of piece than like any kind of – but holy fuck, honestly, that was one of the best like performances I have ever seen of any band, anytime, anywhere. Like they were – incredible. Like it was a 2 hour show and every element from like the band sounded amazing. Peter Garrett's voice still sounds incredible, like just the range and the power in it. But the actual way the show was designed and the lighting and the graphics, it was just like I could compare it to was the only time I've ever seen Radiohead. And I remember it was probably like 2012, 2013 when I saw Radiohead, and it was a really — it wasn't just about the music. Like you were just in this experience where it's like an art show in some cases, like just the lighting changes and the way they would drift in and out of songs. And it just had this kind of intensity to it. Like, and Peter Garrett too. Like you sort of forget, like it became such a cliche after a while to make fun of Peter Garrett, you know, the way he dances and all that kind of stuff. But then you actually see it and you're like, this is incredible. Like you cannot take your eyes off him. He's just so magnetic. and you just don't know what he's going to do next. Well, you sort of do know what he's going to do next, but you just can't believe that he's doing it. And the whole thing, like that whole crowd, like festival gigs can be so hard because you've got people spilling in from other, you know, they're there to see other bands, whatever. They're not there just to see Midnight Oil. But they had everyone and they were eating out of the palm of their hand. And even Jem, who sort of, you know, she was aware of Midnight Oil but didn't grow up here, so she didn't have that kind of parochial. But she was like, that was one of the greatest concerts I've ever seen. And she's like, they're so hardcore. And it's like, yeah, man. Like at some stages, it was like a punk show. Like he was just fucking angry and out there and just riling the crowd up. And everyone was just like, I think there was a lot of pent up kind of like aggression just from, you know, 2 years of not being able to go for festivals, plus all the fucking shit that everyone's been through in the last few years. And it was just great. It was just this real release. But I tell you what, Will, if you want a funny.
Can I just, before you go on to your funny thing. So
yeah.
I saw Midnight Oil about 3 years ago, whenever that last tour they did before this one was. And
2018, I think it was.
So I saw them at the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl in Melbourne, and they were incredible. I've been very lucky to see them a lot over my lifetime. And from before I was even involved in the music industry in any way, like even through radio or anything, they just used to tour Canberra a lot when I was at university. So I saw them a bunch when they were they would do their big show, but they'd then go play at like the ANU Uni Bar and stuff like that. So it was like they were one of the real formative bands of like when I was getting into music. But the thing that I've always found incredible about them, and I think that Cold Chisel are a bit like this, they're not exactly the same, but they're very smart bands that have this mass appeal to people who don't necessarily engage just with how smart they are. Like, and that is the great appeal. Like you can just love Midnight Oil, or you could just love Cold Chisel for the music without thinking too much about what the stories are about and what the meaning behind it is about and those sort of things. In fact, yeah, they're one of those hilarious bands like Rage Against the Machine where occasionally somebody's like, well, why are you making it so political? And you're like, well, because the 30 years of them making music has all been absolutely political. What did you think Blue Sky Mine was about, dude? Like, you know, this has literally been all they've ever done. But because the actual performance is that of a tradition, well, not traditional, but like it looks like rock a rock band. And roll show and a rock and roll band, and you have a charismatic front person who is as charismatic as, you know, Mick Jagger or somebody like that in the way that he controls the stage, then you forget that they are an overtly political band, despite the fact that they wear the fact that they're an overtly political band very proudly.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I was thinking about that, you know, watching him dance on stage, and, you know, it's such a distinct, you know, the way he moves and stalks the stage. And I was like, how many lead singers are there that are so unique that you can impersonate them just physically? Like, yeah, you're right, Mick Jagger, you can do that sort of duck walk that Mick Jagger does. Maybe you could do like a Liam Gallagher if you just put your arms behind your back and, you know, or Lemmy, you put the microphone up there. But there's only one Peter Garrett. Like as soon as someone starts doing that off timing click, you know, at the front and the side, like, you know, it's Peter Garrett. And yes, that thing about the political, I was annoying the people I was with because every 5 minutes I'd turn around and go, look, I love the songs, but when do they get so political? And people are like, okay. After like the fifth or sixth time, people are like, we get it, Charlie. That's very funny.
We get the joke.
But I did wonder if there were people in the crowd who, like you say, were like, yeah, they're just here because the rock element of it was so good, and the, you know, they would do these kind of, and it was so melodic as well. Like that they're such great musicians that it's really heavy music, but you could hear every part of it. And we were standing right next to the mixing desk, and I was looking at the engineer, and he was about, you know, 70. And I reckon this guy must be their permanent, you know, sound engineer, because he knew the band so well that it was just calibrated perfectly, where you could hear every individual instrument, but also it was balanced in a way that you got this wall of sound washing over you that was just, it's hard to describe, but there's just those gigs you go to where you just like, after even the opening, which was like a fairly low-key, moody opening where they sung one of their new songs, We Resist, and it was just them in silhouette and stuff, but by the end of it, you were like, fuck yeah, let's tear down the system, man. Like, it's just, they had that Rage Against the Machine kind of element where they, you know, even if you weren't listening to the lyrics, it's just something about it makes, like, fires you up and gets you really, like, angry. And it was beautiful at one point because, believe it or not, Will, Peter Garrett had some things to say about the state of the world and the state of politics.
How does he think we're going?
Oh, not good.
What was
He reduced ScoMo to "he shall not be named." Like he actually said that I'm not gonna grant him the dignity of even using his name. But at one point, because like,
is there any chance he was talking about Voldemort?
Yeah,
and you just misunderstood.
Yeah, well, the podcast Mark could tell us. He was going on and on and on about "he shall not be named." But he did this great little he tricked the audience because he was getting them more and more fired up by this laundry list of, you know, things that the current government has fucked up, and you know the way they've been awarding welfare and stuff, and you know favoring certain seats to other seats, and he's been doing this and that. And then he started going on about cognitive bias, and he's like, "That's when you just accept information." So you've got climate scientists, you know, saying this, and this is the data, and this is a fact. It's incontrovertible. But then you've got people with cognitive bias who are just refusing to do that and giving money to mining companies. And the crowd's like, "Fuck yeah, yeah, fuck ScoMo, fuck Mo." And he's gone, "It's just like the anti-vaxxers and Mullumbimby." No, and then you just see the audience go, "Wait, fuck, no, that's us, shit."
Yes.
It was brilliant. It was so good. It was so good the way he got it in there. And then you sort of had like, you saw the fist up, then the fist sort of came down again. And then it's like, oh no, what do we do? He's making a good point, but he's also making a point about us.
I mean, but he's got you by then. That's what I love is he's like, you've cheered already about the last thing. Yeah. You've gone early. You could have held your applause until the end.
So it was awesome. The one misstep was he started doing, he does great banter, Peter Garrett. And by the way, has anyone ever thought of, has there been like a Pixar movie set in a supermarket or something that's all about the secret life of vegetables? And there's a rock band called, I don't know, Midnight Olive Oil, and the lead singer is Peter Carrot.
Oh, great. Good stuff. This is all good stuff.
Has that been done? Because if it hasn't, let's do that. Let's do an animated kids film, and there's a band called Midnight Olive Oil, and the lead singer is Peter Carrot. And he's just a really tall, bald carrot who's always like complaining about the state of the supermarket and that the fruit get too much while the vegetables are left with the scraps.
Now, there is a, I'm looking here, I Googled Peter Carrot, and the first thing that's come up is Peter Carrot Top. So we might have two new characters, a combination of Peter Garrett, Peter Rabbit, and Carrot Top. But apparently,
Carrot Top, Peter Carrot Top.
There is a series of books called Peter Carrot, the beginning, the first book in the Peter Carrot tales, and it doesn't seem to have anything to do with Midnight Olive Oil. No,
Midnight Olive Oil. So do you reckon we can copyright that?
I'm going to Google Midnight Olive Oil and see what comes up. And I think if we get away with this one, we might be right. We're fine. I think we're fine. We can definitely do that.
All right, awesome. Midnight Olive Oil with their lead singer, Peter Carrot. So the one misstep that Peter Carrot made with his banter was he started talking about, we're back on the road now and this is our farewell tour. Oh, and by the way, I wasn't aware of this. So they're wrapping up. This is the last tour that they're going on. I'm pretty sure they mean it. I don't think it's like a John Farnham kind of thing. So if you have the chance to see them, I'm definitely going to go see them again. I'd like to see them in a smaller, dedicated venue, I think, because it'd be even better. But run, go see this band. Even if you don't think you are into Midnight Oil, you'll be into this because it's just such a great show. But as he was doing his banter about, we're back on the road and stuff, he started going on about like the Gold Coast, and I'm like, where is this going? He's like, normally they put us up in a hotel in town, but we couldn't get there. So they put us up into the Gold Coast, and he's like, the Gold Coast, it's just overrated. And I'm like, what the fuck is he talking? It sounds like Will Anderson here.
He's like, the Gold Coast. That is definitely my material, Peter Garrett. You be very careful about what you're doing. Like, the person who talks about the Gold Coast being shit is me.
Yeah. So he's going on about like just listing Gold Coast localities that are just underwhelming. And he's like, so it's just like the movie world, and he's gone, and what's the most underrated is Dream World. And then they go into Dream World. And I'm like, oh, that sucks. And so I was thinking about it and I'm like, oh, you know who's really good at that kind of shit is Will. Like, you're really good at just kind of like, you know, wordplay and that kind of stuff. So I've got their set list here.
All right.
So let's just pretend you're Peter Garrett.
So I have to do a little preamble to introduce the song.
Yeah, I'm going to give you the song.
Okay, great.
So you've got a little earpiece in. So you're on stage in front of everyone. Uh-huh. And you've forgotten the order of the set list. So I'm just going to feed you the names of the songs. And you've got to do it as one continuous conversation.
Let's pretend
the songs, you throw to a song after you finish a little preamble.
Yep.
But then we'll just go into the stage.
No, I understand.
So the skill with this, you can't break stride. Okay, so just start your general banter.
All right. Welcome everybody to the welcome to the Byron Bay Blues Festival. It is so nice to be here in such an important time for this country.
We resist. Your first song is We Resist.
The next 5 weeks are going to be filled with manipulation and lies coming from politicians, coming from the media. But there is only one way forward for this country. We have to do it together. This is We Resist. Da-na-na-na. Anyway. Okay.
So go into your next bit of banter. Thank you.
Thank you. That was We Resist, and I hope that you will resist all the temptations thrown in your direction.
The next song is the Barker Darling River.
The Barker Darling River. Obviously,
don't say that to the microphone. The audience is like, what's he? Is he talking to a guy on his earpiece?
We will be having to look after so many parts of this beautiful country. We need to get together the Uluru Statement with the original owners of this country. And remember, this country was stolen and never ceded. I've forgotten the name of the river.
The Barker Darling River.
So we're going to have to look after every part of this country, from Uluru to the Great Barrier Reef that's being bleached by climate change, to the Barker Darling River.
Okay. No, next song is Nobody's Child.
Thank you very much. That was the Narkabala River.
Narkabala, Barker Darling.
It's so... Barker Darling.
No, not Barker Darling. Barker Darling. Abort. The next song is Nobody's Child.
We believe in a world where billionaires should not own half of the world's wealth, and nobody's child should live in poverty.
Din, din, din. Okay, Dream World. We know how that one goes. Okay, the next song is Stand in Line.
I would like to say everywhere out there that they did not know there was going to be as many people at the festival today. Some of the toilets and the amenities are being overwhelmed. But if you are there, please make sure you stand in line.
Oh, that is the worst one yet. That's literally just an OH&S statement from the lead singer of a rock and roll band, a protest band, no less.
You got a message going, look, the bar lines are really long. If you could just say something, Peter, to really calm people down.
You know what? They actually were. They were tremendously long and front on. Okay, the next one is Now or Neverland.
This is Now or Neverland.
The rest of the band is just staring at you. Okay. What about I Don't Want to Be the One?
We realize that the odds are tonight that 1 in 5 people are going to get COVID, and we're a 5-piece band, so one of us is going to get COVID. And I don't want to be the one.
All right, next song is My Country.
We're an Australian band. We've always been an Australian band. This is not your country. This is not my country. But this is my country.
Yeah. Ah, nice. Beautiful. Okay. US forces.
There's been a lot of talk about floods in this area recently, but obviously what you need right now is government submarines that are being supplied by the US forces.
And Kosciuszko.
Here's a list of my favorite mountains. Everest, Kosciuszko. This is Kosciuszko.
All right, let's skip a couple. How about Dead Heart? The Dead Heart.
The Dead Heart. Okay. the
Oh no, not as easy as it looks. Now all of a sudden, like bagging out the Gold Coast. I'm understanding why.
Oh, no, here we go.
Did
no,
that old here we clumsy go. Intro about the Gold Coast.
Okay. Great Australian left us recently. He was the greatest cricketer this country has ever produced. He wore the number 23 on his back. There were crowds that stood and awed at what he did. This is for Shane Warne. This is the Dead Heart.
I think that's a little insensitive, isn't it? Like, I mean, if the song was the greatest or something, but to actually just do a song about like the failing organ that killed one of our greatest cricketers.
It's technically true.
Okay, how about King of the Mountain?
This one's dedicated to Peter Brock. Oh,
topical. okay. Blue Sky Mine.
This one's dedicated to the billionaires who think that they don't need to solve the problems here on Earth and they need to blast off into space to look for new planets to live on. Blue Sky Mine.
Ah, yeah. Well done. You guys are the best. Rock and roll. did you see? So interesting. As an interesting thread went out on Twitter this week about Elon Musk and his attempts to buy Twitter. And it was written by a guy who used to run Reddit. Did you read that thread?
So just can I just say this before we get to the thread? So I may even have evidence of this that might be in one of my improv shows or my – but – definitely in my show notes when I was trying to write Will Logical, I had this bit all about billionaires going to space. It didn't end up making the show. But one of the bits, and maybe we even had like half of this conversation on a TOEFOP, which was about if I was a billionaire, I would never go on Twitter. But in the jokes that I'd written about it, I'd be like, actually, if I was a billionaire, I would buy Twitter. And I would then like, you know, use it to fuck with Twitter. And then like 3 months later, that's what like, I'm so glad that wasn't my material because it would have been ruined by Elon Musk doing that exact same thing.
What's strange, isn't it? Like what is the well, this thread is really interesting because this thread is all about like, so Elon Musk's motivation apparently is like, he feels like, you know, Twitter is not democratic enough. It's not recognizing enough voices. So this guy who started Reddit, he said, look, you know, this is, here's my experiences of trying to set up some kind of democratized social media forum where everyone can come express their views. He's gone, it just doesn't work because every group feels like they are being censored. Every group feels like they're being silenced. And also the moderation of online content is virtually impossible. Like there are just not enough people and not enough eyeballs to stay across stuff. So yeah, like you might be on the right and you're like, well, this leftist, you know, called for my murder and how come they got away with it? Well, that just got slipped through. But also a white supremacist also called for someone to get murdered as well. Like it is an imperfect system. But my question is, what does Elon Musk have to complain about? Does he feel his voice is not being heard? Does he feel like he's not getting enough publicity?
Well, one of the jokes that I had in this thing that I wrote was like, you know, they shouldn't be able to go on the free apps. Like if you want the public to know your opinion when you're a billionaire, you should have to do what people traditionally did and buy a newspaper, you know, buy a media company. Mm. That's what billionaires normally do to get it out there. So I guess that is actually just the equivalent of what he's doing. He's doing something that has been done by billionaires throughout the ages, which is we need to control the media because if we control the media, we control the narrative around the fact that like Elon Musk owns a disproportionate amount of wealth. Like that is the, like regardless of any, you know, good that he brings to the world, there is no way that the world benefits from somebody disproportionately having that much wealth. And the best way for him to control that conversation is to control the conversation.
Yeah. But every time, like, couldn't he just start his own, like to start Musk chat or something like that, where people can just go like for billionaires.
I mean, that sounds gross. Musk.
It does sound disgusting. But there's like dating agencies for wealthy people. Yeah. Like, you know, like
oh, so you're talking like sugar daddy arrangements?
Yeah. But like, so rich people can go on and converse about being super wealthy and super wealthy first world problems without being shamed by the wider public. Because that's what it feels like he's rebelling against. You know, yeah, he wants to protect his business interests and stuff. But I also think there's an element of him which is like, I don't like the fact that people call me like a scumbag and that, you know, I'm wasting my money when I could be donating to better cause. I want to hang out with other people who are also like me, who just like spending their money on kind of like things that make them happy.
Nobody's like you. You have more than everybody else in the world. There is nobody else like you. You can't like have a peer. Like, I mean, Elon Musk is now even disproportionately wealthy compared to Jeff Bezos. Like, there are Elon Musk problems that Bezos doesn't face. Like, they can't even have a chat backstage about like what it's like to be disproportionately wealthy. So, but you shouldn't need, it's sad to me that like, I mean, this is a reflection that why we shouldn't be giving these people all this fucking money, because they're not geniuses. They're not, you know, these absolute, I mean, they can have moments of genius, but they are not so more disproportionately talented than the next person that they should have so much more than the next person.
Yeah. Well, especially too, when a lot of it's inherited wealth as well. Like, if it had been Elon down the mines or whatever, his family got their money, whatever shady shit in South Africa that they were doing to amass their fortune. Like, even if his grandfather had been the one, but I doubt his grandfather was the one actually pulling the diamonds from the stones. Like, it's very...
No, it wasn't.
It's very...
Yeah, we had the one ethical South African diamond mine.
I mean, it does feel like that is where the disconnect happened. And it's also to this American thing as well of... Like they had this kind of hero worship where it's like, you know, they Australians, we love tearing down a hero. Like, you know, we're suspicious of people who elevate themselves above others. Where in America, it's a culture that kind of like celebrates, you know, the rags to riches story and anyone can become president and blah blah blah. And so, you know, when that wealth is just becomes evidence of your skill or evidence of your work ethic or whatever, when so often it is just a case of it's evidence that you were born. You were born with the right surname.
Right. And the fact that, like, I think in Australia there is more of a connection between, like, if you got wealthy or successful for doing something is more admired than, like, you know, that idea in America where if you're just rich, people almost are like, how you got to be rich is really very much a secondary question. Like, the cool thing is that you're rich.
Yeah. Yeah, you meet a lot of those people, like, I don't know how many you met when you're in LA, but I met a lot of like producers and they were just like guys and girls who had come from money and were now just in LA with money. Like, they'd been given a bank account and a credit card and told to, you know, do what they want with it. So they're out trying to make things and so they're, you know, throwing parties so they can meet celebrities and studio people so they can just put their money into something and feel like they're part of something, but they're not actually talented. Like, they don't, you know, they have the ability to fund talent and to attract talent, but they don't necessarily have the talent themselves. But that is kind of like a career path for super wealthy. Like, in Australia, we don't really have enough of an industry for super wealthy people to kind of like take that risk. Like, it's very hard to raise private finance for music festivals, film production, all that kind of stuff in Australia. Whereas in America, there is a lot of that independent financing because people just want to meet Julia Roberts. It's kind of a
and people don't have the
it's a legitimate like, business
but
strategy.
People aren't willing to get their checkbook out for Aiden Nicodemo.
I would have thought
there'd be like at least some, I mean, maybe not to the scale of a Julia Roberts, right, but I imagine that like there'd be some independently wealthy people would just be like, you know, I grew up watching Ada on TV and I'd like to
hang out with her.
Do an Ada. Yeah, I'd like to hang out with Ada, so I'm going to put together an Ada project.
You know what? There probably is. I know when Gemma was attached to a project a couple of years ago in America, like an independent film, and when she got the script, she was like, you know, it's okay. It needs some work, maybe with like if we do another couple passes. And the manager who bought the script said, oh, the one caveat is the girl who wrote this script, she has to be in it. And Jem was like, okay, fine. Well, what's her experience? It's like, well, she hasn't really done anything. And Jem's like, well, this is a really, like, you know, this requires like a really skilled actor. Like, it's a pretty big part. You know, maybe we can look at like creating like a supporting role or something that's sort of more suited to her level of experience. And then the more that they got through the development, the more that like Jem started to realize that this girl actually hadn't done anything and possibly hadn't even written this script, but her husband was very, very wealthy and had wanted to give her a film. But it was amazing because they did, like, they literally had $1 million to dangle in front of, they're trying to get like, you know, a big name actor to get into this to, and that would get the ball rolling. But just that they as much as Gem tried to get them to rewrite the script and change it, they wouldn't do it. They kept sort of insisting that it had to stay a certain way. And it was all based around the fact that this woman, this was her project that was being funded by her partner. And it was like, Gem left it and we sort of vaguely have tracked it, and it keeps being announcements. They keep getting directors attached and then a star, and then it just falls over because everyone is running to the same problem, which is like, we can't put this person in this film. Like, even for $1 million, like even for $1 million, we can't do it. We're either not going to be able to attract professional talent to work with you, or it's just people sort of just see the red flag. Just like, well, if this is what you're asking now, like you're already putting restrictions on now, when we actually start rolling the cameras, what other demands are going to start? You know, and agents and managers, that's their job, is to keep their clients separated from that kind of quagmire.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? That sort of super well. So what does that mean for Elon Musk? I think Elon Musk just, he's at the point where he's so wealthy that he's like, if I want to buy Twitter, I should just buy Twitter. And I think that there's some business, obviously, opportunities for him in buying Twitter. Like, there's no real downside to him buying Twitter because he can control narratives. He can use it to continue to manipulate the stock market like he tends to do and all these sort of things. So I imagine for him, like, yeah, and there's probably an opportunity for him to, like, rebrand it a little bit more in a free speech sense. It seems to be what he would like to do.
It annoys me. I use Twitter a lot. I'd say that's my social that's my social media du jour. That's the one I enjoy the most, the one that I check the most. And it's so kind of like cliche for people to come on and go like, I fucking hate this website and it's a fucking dumpster fire and blah, 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 blah. But they're always fucking on it. They're always on it to tell you how much they fucking hate it. And it's like, I accept the fact, I understand it's annoying and it's distracting and social media is ruining our brains. But it's kind of like, I know that if I have a few beers, that's not the best thing for me. If I have a lot of beers, that's even worse for me. So I have accepted the fact that I'm going to do this thing that is not great for my health, but it improves my life in other ways. It gives me a point of distraction. It enables me to promote our podcast, all this kind of stuff. But this idea that somehow it needs to be changed, I just think it is what it is. It is a fucking dumpster fire, but it's also this great tool. You know, that's how people in the floods have been updating on where to fucking send help and reaching out, because there certainly hasn't been any fucking coordinated response.
Well, what you say is the thing that about Twitter more than anything, and this is the thing that nobody can actually handle about it, which is your experience is entirely of your own curation.
Yes.
So if you're following a whole bunch of like terrible accounts, then that's your fault. Like, it literally is a website where you go on and choose people, resources to follow. There is a whole bunch of different ways that you can follow and engage with them. And your experience is entirely of your own making. Like, the easiest, Twitter doesn't need to change everything. You just need to unfollow a few people and follow a few more, like get your balance of your account out better. Like, I mean, for example, during political times, I'll follow a lot more journalists than I would ordinarily. But as soon as, you know, the election's over, I'll unfollow a whole bunch of those journalists again because I just don't need to see on a daily basis like the updates of those things that I just don't need to engage in.
Yeah, there's one comedian that I followed, and then after a while I was like, oh, I'm going to unfollow because I just was getting weary of the text. And then I was like, oh, you know what, I'll follow again. And then I realized after a day I made a mistake, so I unfollowed, and then I got blocked. Because obviously they were watching me jump back and forth and they're like, fuck this guy. He's either a fan or he's not. And so I was like, oh yeah, fuck it. I'll just stay offline. There's certain aspects of their work that I like, but there's other aspects that I don't need in my feed all the time. So it's probably better for all of us.
Oh, well, it was like Dave Hughes was trying to cull his Instagram, the people he followed on Instagram, and he rang me up on the radio to, like, basically did this thing where he sent out like an Instagram direct message to people, and then if people didn't respond, he like got them on the radio to say, I'm going to drop you from my Instagram things. And I was like, mate, drop me. Absolutely drop me. I don't want my friends to be following me on my social media because my social media is mostly work related. So, like, you don't need to see me promoting my shows. You don't need me to see me promoting other people's shows or anything like that. That is not for you.
Have you started any friendships on social media that have bled into the real world? Where it's like, you know, someone starts following you, you start following them, you like each other's posts, you start communicating, and there's like a online friendship, and then has it become a real world friendship?
I mean, I think that's hard for me to say external to the media world in which we live. So like there's so many comedians or other people in the media or whatever, like philosophy guests that I've made connections with solely online originally, and then that's become a podcast and then a friendship. But I don't know if there's been independently of that many that I could identify. Mate, you know what? There's a few that like where social media has been pretty like, I mean, someone like Craig Coombs, for example, if it hadn't been for social media, like we wouldn't have the opportunity to have the bond and friendship that we have. Like a lot of that has been conducted through, I mean, we text each other now, but we still communicate a fair amount of the time through social media.
Yeah. There's a few people lately who have been, who I only know through social media, through their social media accounts. And then we've been messaging and stuff. And one of them was like, hey man, well, next time you're in town, hit me up and we'll grab a bite to eat or something to drink. And I'm like, I don't know about that. Like, I've enjoyed the separation, and I'm just like, I don't know if I want to take that next step. I don't know if this is a real, I mean, I'm hard to, I don't make new friends really anyway, even in real life, like person to person, I'm a pretty hard nut to crack. And so the idea of them like having to get over the hump, like I think if you do invite someone onto a podcast or something, that's still like another distance away, like especially now that we're doing it via Zoom. Like even before Zoom, we're doing it in person. It was still a bit of a risk to get in the room with that person. But now, fuck yeah, I'll just like hit someone up and say, hey, would you like to do my show? And we can just do it like this. And it's absolutely fine. But I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, I just don't, I feel like, dating apps didn't exist when I was single. And it's the same thing of if suddenly I was single and I wanted to meet someone again, would I use a dating app? Because I just, my brain isn't wired to connect those two worlds. And I have met people in real life that have only known online and been kind of like underwhelmed by their real personalities. I'm like, I really like the way you write. Or I really like the things you post. But you as a person, I don't think we're going to be friends.
Well, I'm not a big poster. Like I was obviously early in the days of social media. Like I used to use it a lot, but I haven't used it in an active way really for
You're a big retweeter.
Yeah. Like, but I really, it takes a lot for me to actually, contribute something to the conversation. Cause so often I just, particularly in the last couple of years, you've seen people have complete meltdowns and just like the debate engagement online is just at such ferocious levels on all sides that it doesn't feel like a healthy place. And the few times when I've like, you get caught at that moment where you bite back or you respond to something, there is not one of those that I've walked away from and gone, well, that was a good use of my time. I feel heaps better that I engaged in that.
Yeah, it is. I often get that rush of blood, but I've been very disciplined in not responding and have been provoked several times, especially like even in jest as a St. Gilda supporter, there's some people who are like trying to pick a fight with me right now. I'm like, I'm not going to win that. I'm just not going to win it. And at the moment, I sort of went off social media last year or, during COVID, I was like, it's too much. And I think I've reintroduced it at a healthy level now, which is the bulk of my tweeting is around TOEFOP, two guys, one cup, whatever. And some occasional just like, dead time browsing. But I used to get sucked into threads of arguments that had nothing to do with me, like two celebrities are fighting or there's some fucking issue. And I'd go down a rabbit hole of this exchange. And like, there was even some guy who I was following because he did a funny tweet like 5 years ago and I'd been following him and he's kind of funny. He's just like a normal dude, not a comedian or anything like that. But then he started going on this like anti-Dan Illick rant. Like he just, Dan just like rubs in the wrong way. After the billboard thing, he was just like, fuck this guy and, what a useless waste of time. And I'm just like, and I was really tempted to be like, what the fuck are you doing with your time? Like, well, who are you? And then I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing with my time? I don't even, like you say, I have created this world. I am following this guy. And so if his responses to Dan Illick, for whatever reason, are pissing me off, then that's my fault. And so I did. I just unfollowed him. And it's been so much better. Now I don't have to follow any of that shit anymore. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah. And what you've like done there is going, I do not need to insert myself into something that like Dan makes provocative work. So Dan understands that part of that is that people are going to debate the merits of what it is you do. And in fact, I would argue that Dan, probably more than anybody in the Australian media landscape, operates very much in the window of trying to start conversations.
Yeah.
Like, you know, do provocative things to try to start conversations. Like, you don't go to Dan for all the answers. Like, you know, it's not like, you know, what's this plan that you're going to... He's the person who's trying to agitate to make sure that people are at least paying attention to the topics and doing it in a fun and funny way. And I think there's great merit in that. If there are other people who want to argue that that's self-serving or doesn't do enough or any of these sort of things, then I think Dan knows that's part of the debate that he's almost... The reason that other people don't do that is that they know that when you do something like that, it comes with those criticisms that, you know, it's all about you, or it's like, you know, it's really about you getting a Tonight Show rather than you caring about the issues or any of those sort of things. Dan has the courage to know that those criticisms were going to come and be like, I'm going to do it anyway, even though I will get these sort of criticisms, which I greatly admire. But he doesn't need you or I to defend him and weigh in on that. Like, no. He is absolutely fine without us, you know, getting involved in that debate.
And it's also that thing too of, you know, that classic sort of Twitter trope where it's like you could say the most beautiful, innocuous statement about, you know, I saw my child laugh for the first time today, it made me so happy. And then someone would be like, fuck you, some people can't have children. Some people don't have the power of speech. Yeah. So delete this right now. Yeah.
Some people can't laugh. Exactly. What do you think about the people who can't laugh?
You mean listeners to TOEFOP? Is that what you're describing?
No, they won't laugh, not can't laugh.
Let's get to the mailbag before we say goodbye. Actually, before we get to the mailbag, let's let people know about our Patreon, patreon.com/TOEFOP. Still the best way to support our show. We had our sponsors' revenue statement come in for the last 3 months. Fair to say it was very scant. In fact, I was like, hang on, is this for the last 3 months or for one episode? Because this is not a lot. So the best way to support our show is still through Patreon. And so we do our best to put a lot of bonus content up there. We just put a brand new bonus episode up a few days ago. So we'll do those every fortnightly when possible. And we do full videos of the show. So if you want to sit with us for the full hour of TOEFOP, you can do that at patreon.com. Plus, we've got all our exclusive James Fosdyke artwork there. We've got Everyone Relax. We've got Quantum Cop, a bunch of behind the scenes photos, some really good stuff. You could spend hours going through the Patreon for some bonus TOEFOP content. And if you want to sign up at the top tier, there's a prize. We offer an autographed tour poster from one of our Melbourne Comedy Festival shows, signed by Will and I, authenticated. I mean, I don't know how we can prove the authentication, but just trust us. We were there. We signed them. And so if you sign up at the $20 level, even if it's only for a month, you just want to support us by giving us $20 for 1 month and then switch down to a lower amount, we're totally fine with that. We'll send you a poster. And then if you send us a message via Patreon that we read out on our bonus episode, you could also get a fridge magnet. So, Will, why wouldn't you support our Patreon?
I mean, why wouldn't you? And please do, because we have no other sponsors.
We have no others. It was really shocking. It was really, really shocking. Okay, let's get to this mail. Actually, before we do that, why don't you promote your show as well? Well, I'll bring up the mailbag.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Willogical is the name of my touring show. So I've got a week to go in Melbourne. So I would love you to come out and see the show. I'm actually super proud of it. It feels very much like a show now, and it's got the tone and vibe of what I was going for. So I've done enough shows now that it feels a bit more natural and fun. So please come and see that. And then on the final night of the festival, I do What You Talking About, Will, my improvised stand-up show. Then the first weekend of May, I am at the Enmore doing Willogical, and then on the Sunday night doing What You Talking About, Will. And then at the election weekend, I will be in Brisbane. So two nights of Willogical, and then one of the nights of Willogical is on election night. So that might be a fun night to come and share whatever happens in that room on the Saturday night. And then on the Sunday, I will be doing my improvised show, What You're Talking About, Will. In fact, I'm doing two of them in a row, two different shows. And I imagine that I'll probably talk about what happened in the election.
Also, you can listen to our AFL podcast or AFL adjacent podcast, Two Guys, One Cup, which is on the Listener app. In fact, if you want to support this show in a way that is not financial, that only requires you to sign up to an app. That would be the best way to do it, because obviously, listener, they have advertising. So the more listeners we get on the show, the better it is for us. And that means we can continue to get paid, which means we can continue to do the show. So it all feeds back to us.
Yeah. Technically, even if you don't listen to the AFL show, but you want to contribute to TOEFOP without...
They have to do it. There is a very complex algorithm. Like, even if you don't have to listen to it, but just go to Two Guys, One Cup.
No, that's what I was about to say. Like, so every week, rather than donating money, if you could just go to the listener app, push play on the episode, you can leave your phone in the other room. You don't have to listen to it all. You can turn it right down, just play it the whole way through.
And that's good for us.
That's fine.
That makes us, the algorithm will tell our bosses that we're doing a good job. So that's the best way to support us if you can't do it financially. All right.
We've had a huge spike in people playing the show under a pillow in their bedrooms.
We're running out of time, so let's just do one letter. This is from Roy.
Yep.
Short time listener, first time caller. You can read as much of my name as you want. Just bear in mind that if you Google it, I am not the Sheriff of Nottingham. Okay. Well, do you know what the Sheriff of Nottingham's real name is? I didn't know this. Do you want to,
Roy.
Yes. And his surname? Well, you're just Googling it now, are you, cheat?
No, Roy Nottingham.
Greensmith. I did not know the Sheriff of Nottingham had a name, but there you go. He's Roy Greensmith. I've been listening since my wife told me to listen to an episode where our daughter is mentioned. Oh, goodness. Okay. Unfortunately, that episode lacked any advice on how to listen to the podcast, and so I did my usual of starting from episode one and listening through the whole thing. That was sometime during the pandemic, and I've just caught up to present day, so I thought I'd contact you about a major development while I wait for the next episode. How excited are you guys for the new Hey Hey It's Saturday special, which I assume will have aired by the time you get to this mail? Love the pod. Been a long-time fan of Will's work, although Charlie is my favorite, as he reminds me of my best mate, Roy. Thanks, mate. I had no idea. Did you know there was another Hey Hey?
It's on tonight. Special on the day we're recording this, Sunday. Oh, it is on tonight. So not too bad for us getting to this mail in real time. So
mail, but by the time they listen to it, it'll be 3 days later.
Yeah, but the joke is, because I think they did a 50 years of Hey Hey It's Saturday. So I think this one is called... What is this one called, Charlie?
50 years or so. I don't know.
The last one was 50. The last one they did was 50 years of Hey Hey It's Saturday. What's this? Was
51 years of Hey Hey It's Saturday?
Yeah. No, it's 100 years of Hey Hey It's Saturday. That's the joke. It's 100 years of Hey Hey It's Saturday.
I don't get it. What? Is it just because they've been around forever? That's the joke?
I don't know what the joke is, but the joke is that it is now 100 years of Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Is Daryl going to come out with like an old man wig on and like a walking stick? That's what it feels like they're leading towards. It's like, you know, Ozzy Ostrich will be in like
I can't imagine there'll be anything that well thought out. Ozzy won't be on it. Ozzy's dead, man.
Well, that's even better.
You can't have Ozzy on.
That makes more sense. I'll just cut through a tombstone. And John Blackman can be like, oh, they can do the angel. The angel can be like, oh, I'm up in heaven and Ozzy's up here. Molly's gay. Roy, the Sheriff of Nottingham, I will not be tuning in. I do not care. I like watching old Hey Hey It's Saturday clips with Johnny Depp because I think that is interesting, but I have no interest in watching 100-year-old Hey Hey It's Saturday. Will?
I probably will watch it at some stage. I think it's on at this. I did sneakily have a look at when it was on tonight, and I think if I come home straight after my show, I might relax post-show by catching the last half an hour of the Hey Hey It's Saturday special.
I mean, off a side point, and this is more a Two Guys, One Cup conversation, but Scott Dooley messaged me from New York. He just arrived back in New York, and he's desperate to talk about the new Fox Footy show After the Game. Which I haven't watched yet, but it's in that long tradition of sports comedy variety shows. Scott really hasn't seen it, but he wants me to watch it because he needs to get the lowdown on it. And it did make me think of that time that you and I, after a game, came back to your place and we watched The Bounce and we started off like making fun of it. But then by the end of it, we like had genuine admiration for the dynamics between like the cast. It's like, oh, I get it. Yeah, Jason Dunstall's going to the straight man and Danny Frawley's going to let the goofy one and they put Andrew Gaze in a headlock and, you know, give him a wedgie and stuff like that. There's some merit to this.
Right. It's well cast. It has a balance. Everybody knows their role. It's kind of like the old footy version of a boy band. You know, they just like There's something that appeals to everybody.
It's comedy and bullying all wrapped up in one package. What's more entertaining than that?
Nothing. The end.
Strong finish. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Will Anderson.
This podcast is a TOEFOP production.
Head to TOEFOP.com for more.
Cool things for cool people.